Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reid Robison, and I try to answer the question, can psychedelics help treat addiction? We discuss some of the exciting research being done on psychedelic therapies for addiction, like psilocybin-assisted therapy for nicotine and alcohol use disorders, or ibogaine for opiate use disorder. We also explore the factors that contribute to and perpetuate addiction, and how the perspective-granting power of a psychedelic experience might be uniquely helpful for someone seeking to break free from an addictive relationship to a substance or a behavior pattern. If any of you are listening and are looking for a good training and education program pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, check out Numinous's programs. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection. And you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off of selected trainings. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing to the show, leaving us a review in a place like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and then you can share the episode with somebody that you think might benefit. Please enjoy today's episode on addiction. How you doing, Reid? Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers.
Pretty good. Happy 4th of July tomorrow.
We're recording this on the 3rd, squeezing it in before we enjoy the festivities. So we thought we'd talk a bit about psychedelics and addiction today. I've got this little section I pulled from a New York Times article about the topic that I thought I'd read as a fun little intro to what's going on in the world of psychedelics and addiction.
Do it.
So from this New York Times article, take Amy Jameson, who several years ago wanted to kick her cigarette habit before her 50th birthday. Statistically speaking, Miss Jameson's chance of success wasn't great. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 55% of adult smokers tried to quit in 2018, but only 8% were successful. Ms. Jameson, an investor, blah, blah, blah. In the fall of 2018, she flew to Baltimore to participate in a clinical trial at Johns Hopkins. When she had to abstain from nicotine for a day before a brain scan, she could barely sleep and called it, quote, the most hellish 24 hours I've experienced. So, you know, speaking to how difficult it can be to quit and nicotine. After three talk therapy sessions at the Hopkins Clinic, she was given a single pill containing 30 milligrams of psilocybin, a relatively high dose. 30 milligrams roughly equating to what? 3 dried grams of mushrooms, depending on the strain.
3 plus.
Yeah. After swallowing the pill, she put on an eye mask, lay on a couch, and went on a psychedelic trip with two therapists nearby for the next 5 hours. When her trip ended, she sat up and looked at the therapist and said, "Now I understand why I smoked." She then said, "And I don't need to do that anymore."
Wow.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think that study, I think you looked it up. Mm-hmm. The majority of participants were able to remain abstinent up to a year later, I think.
Yeah. So the smoking cessation study at Hopkins, the big one that I believe is ongoing, is the first government-funded psychedelic study of this modern renaissance. But there was a pilot study that Matt Johnson did at Hopkins where they showed 10 out of 15 people quit smoking after a single dose of psilocybin for at least 1 year.
Mm-hmm. And did they do, I forget it, did they do a comparison group with like Chantix and other medicines, or was it just a placebo group? Or?
I think this was, and I could be wrong, my assumption is that it's a small open label pilot, because the quit rate is known on things. Like I've prescribed more nicotine patches than I could ever count. Mm-hmm. Like everyone coming into a treatment center, for example. And those things, of course, don't get at the core. Like, you know, you're swapping behaviors, and that there's a lot to be said about that strategy when there's something with a known, you know, carcinogen effect,
right,
for example.
Yeah, not getting at the core, I think, is an interesting topic to explore when we're talking about psychedelic-assisted treatment or therapy for substance use disorders. Because a lot of research still needs to be done, of course. Mm-hmm. But some of the theories would suggest that the reasons people get addicted to things, either chemicals or behaviors or experiences, has maybe less to do with the chemical hook, and then that varies depending on the chemical we're talking about, and more to do with what might be at the core, a certain degree of suffering that they're trying to address by engaging in the addictive behavior.
Yeah. Maybe we can back up and look at it from a bird's eye view of what's going on, just because addiction is essentially normal human learning process has gone bad, right? In the face of a trigger, which might be a stress, we engage in a behavior to provide some temporary relief, and then that gets reinforced and tends to reoccur. So pretty soon we don't even know we're bringing the cigarette to our mouth, but all that is going on underneath the surface. And therefore these approaches that bring in a light of awareness, psychedelics, mindfulness, both together, become quite powerful because you start to see the patterns, and that's a prerequisite in my opinion for being able to change them.
Right. Okay. So being able to see the patterns and psychedelics, are pretty good for the most part at helping people see patterns from this mindfulness default mode downregulated, you know, perspective. Like this person cited in this article describes, she understood why she was smoking at a sort of a deep felt sense level. And that insight at that level helped her make the durable decision to stop.
Mm-hmm. And she had probably, I'm guessing, tried to quit many times before, if it didn't even, if it didn't mention that, which is such a common phenomenon. And another point to make is, if someone says, I want to change, they're probably telling the truth. But then they keep doing it and people get confused, but behaviors are automatized, right? And, if they're outside of the awareness, we bring them into our awareness, but that doesn't guarantee change, right? There's also a pattern disruption phenomenon in psychedelics that we can chat about. But, while you need that awareness, because you're definitely not doing anything without, there's still what you do with the awareness to get towards full recovery.
Yeah. Speaking more broadly about therapy generally, I think awareness is often a trailhead. It's not the end of the trail. I remember studying Gestalt therapy in high school, not high school, in graduate school. And a critique of at least the sort of Fritz Perls approach was that it was a good process at generating awareness, but there wasn't much more after that. Like, well, what do I do next? And so,
So a trailhead and probably one of the greatest change agents, awareness. I mean, absolutely need it, but there, once you're self-aware, doesn't mean these deeply ingrained patterns, they still might be outside of your self-control.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. So awareness being necessary, not sufficient for change in most cases.
Yeah. And what happens in addiction is kind of unfortunate, because the more a person gets deeper in this deeply ingrained maladaptive pattern, the more the brain, because with this dopamine spike phenomenon, the more the brain gets like hypersensitive to pain, stress. And the more you lose the natural reward from the natural healthy objects around you. And so it becomes this almost perfect storm of misery and stuckness, where you've got your automatic habit, you lose your ability to regulate negative emotions, and you can't experience natural healthy reward in the same way as before. And that's where it can feel like a stuckness.
Yeah. And it's often what drives relapse, right? Because when you're in that trough, that dopamine trough that you're describing, it feels a lot worse than pre-addiction levels of, you know, feeling unwell. So it makes sense that it would drive a person back to this usually simple habit of, in the case of smoking, just, you know, lighting something up or hitting a vape or whatever, to feel better. So it's, I don't know, drug addicts, so-called drug addicts, have been demonized historically, certainly by the war on drugs. And it's inappropriate given what we understand about what happens to a person's mind, their brain, their soul, when they're hooked by a substance like this, by a process like this.
Yeah. It's really tragic that in our country and many countries, not all, thankfully, there are more resources spent on criminalizing and punishing than helping people with their addictions.
Yeah. I read somewhere that, that since its inception in the '70s, the quote war, you know, the so-called war on drugs, that they've spent over $1 trillion propagating this war, this campaign. Whoa. And I don't imagine that a lot of that money went to rehabilitation and treatment.
Yeah, it's so true. But thankfully, we're starting to see little glimmers of hope here and there. Like, did you notice the news about Kentucky a few weeks ago? The state of Kentucky dedicated $42 million to fund psychedelic research focused on addiction.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is pretty awesome.
That's exciting.
But yeah, at the MAPS conference a week or two ago in Denver, I got a couple of these stickers that said, "The war on drugs is the war on us."
Mm. Yeah, it certainly feels that way. Especially when, like, we talked a bit about Carl Hart in our last podcast, reflecting on his speech at the conference, and the war on it doesn't feel like it's what did Nixon call it? Public enemy number one.
Yep.
Right. Yep. That drug addiction is public enemy number one, and I think what it ended up being is the enemy became the addicts. You know, the people who were who fell into these traps.
Yeah, and it became kind of a misused tool or misdirected a tool for kind of racism for certain political agendas. Really unfortunate. And the U.S. has a crazy history with drugs. Like, look at the attempted prohibition of alcohol.
Yeah,
it's wild. But on the flip side, some other good news is that the U.S. is actually leading the world in reforming marijuana policies.
Really?
Yeah, just because of all the states that are sequentially either, you know, opening up medical programs or legalizing it altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have your finger on the pulse of this more than I do. And, I mean, a lot of us wonder if something like cannabis is going to be federally legalized like it is in other countries anytime soon. Who knows? I don't want to wade too deep into political waters because I don't feel qualified to have an intelligent discussion about it, but it's discouraging when you look at, is it Portugal that legalized all drugs at one point?
Yeah. So no one goes to jail in Portugal for possessing drugs, and the government has invested a lot in recovery. Mm-hmm. And certainly divested from the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm. And so Denver decriminalized, was it all plant medicines or psychedelics? Yeah. I wish I had these in my notes. Yep. 'Cause it was kind of funny to see at the psychedelic science conference, like booths selling things or people out front, there was a dude with a bag of like mushroom chocolates and the cops were, you know, 10 yards away from him and they didn't care.
Wow. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. So lots of promise in the research. I just did a cursory Google Scholar search and found a couple of studies. But what are we excited about here, Reed, with psychedelic-assisted therapy as a potential treatment for substance use disorders?
Well, we talked about this a little bit on our last episode, the Ibogaine documentary I saw at the MAPS conference of Night and Light by Lucy Walker. And I think we were talking a bit about Howard Latsoff, but I'm intrigued. I always have been intrigued by Ibogaine and its potential for addiction because just so unique in what it does. Both the awareness of patterns, the pattern disruption and neuroplasticity, but also Ibogaine has this really unique ability to kick the withdrawals out of you. I don't know how. I don't know why. As many Ibogaine papers as I've read, you know, I've never hands-on studied this stuff, but I do want to bring it here to Utah for some addiction studies when the timing's right. But it's fascinating and showing a lot of promise. I think the summary out of this documentary, and it's probably pretty close to what you get from a lit review, is maybe 60%+ of people have success in staying clean for months on end after an Ibogaine experience.
Yeah, you know? It's pretty impressive. There's a 2022 lit review of available research on Ibogaine that I found, over 700 case reports and studies. They said that most of them weren't like rigorously designed, you know, placebo-controlled trials. A lot of them are case reports, but coming to that same conclusion.
Cool.
Ibogaine's interesting too, because it's one of those psychedelics that's different at different dosages, right? Like at lower doses, it's a stimulant, it's an aphrodisiac, and then at these higher doses, it's something very, very different.
Yeah. So other psychedelics for addiction research going on. We talked about smoking cessation with psilocybin. There's psilocybin for alcohol use that's been in the news and promising. Back in the 50s, 60s, there was the LSD for alcoholism. And in the last year or two, there was a review article or meta-analysis that looked back at those and said that LSD therapy for alcoholism was estimated to be about four times as good as treatment as usual, which is taking like acamprosate, a pill that will make you nauseous if you drink.
Zyban, is that what Zyban is?
No, that's a smoking cessation one. This is Campral, would be the brand name. There are other strategies like naltrexone, either by pill or injection, that people do to block cravings. But this one is more of an aversion technique, the one that was the main gold standard and comparator of the LSD paper.
Four times, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
And back then, was it LSD-assisted psychotherapy, or was it sort of yeah. monitored trips?
Yeah, it was done in a with attention to set and setting. But it's interesting, the origin of it. Why don't I just read you something that I think I have it here. This is from an article I wrote with our former colleague, Kirsten, commemorating Bicycle Day a couple years ago. We put this out. It's on Truffle Report. But this is just a little clip on the origin of LSD for alcoholism. So Ottawa, Ontario, 1953. A decade after Hoffman's self-experiment, meaning the Bicycle Day ride, two psychiatrists spent a near sleepless night conversing in an Ottawa, Ontario hotel. Humphrey Osmond and Abraham Hoffer were set to speak at conferences the next day, but instead of resting, they were up late discussing the difficulties of their profession. Their common problem was the challenge of treating patients with alcoholism. At around 4 in the morning, Osmond and Hoffer had an idea. What if LSD could be used to treat alcoholism? Maybe they were drunk at the time.
Or on LSD.
maybe both.
Yeah.
At first, the two friends laughed at themselves. That's absurd. LSD makes you delirious, and so does severe alcohol withdrawal. It's called delirium tremens. Why would we do that? But then the pair of psychiatrists stopped laughing at the idea that lingered, thinking there was something there. From their previous work, Osmond and Hoffer noticed that when alcoholism patients hit rock bottom, they'd go through delirium tremens, a catalyzing experience that, while physically painful, often brought them to a place of well-being, a place of willingness to give up their drinking habits. Could LSD replicate the experience of delirium tremens? Osmond and Hoffer wondered. As they continued to converse, the psychiatrist's idea seemed less and less absurd. What if they purposefully occasioned a difficult but transformative experience in their clients simply by giving them a medicine like LSD? Thus, a hypothesis began to emerge. Mm.
And do I have it right that, like, Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, was involved in psychedelic, at least in LSD research, or at least was a fan of the idea of LSD to occasion that sort of dark night of the soul that would then lead to the willingness to quit for good.
He credits his sobriety in large part to a mystical experience on LSD. Mm. He had a couple experiences that I know of, but when he tried to bring it into the curriculum, bring it to the board, it was absolutely shot down, and he eventually left that board of the organization he founded because there just was not openness to it at that time in that group. And AA has been very important for people. Like I admire the community and the peer mentorship and everything in that program, and think it's saved countless lives. And understandably, in that time and place, and, you know, a boardroom is the stereotypical place to get your psychedelic ideas shot down.
Yeah, where psychedelic ideas go to die.
Yeah, the boardroom.
Your standard boardroom. Yeah.
Except our boardroom.
That's true. and many other boardrooms, actually, now.
MAPS boardroom.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, the willingness variable is really, really fascinating to me, because, like we started talking about, people who are in the throes of addiction want to stop.
Right? Yeah.
And they'll make several attempts to quit. like you were describing earlier, there's lots of reasons why it can be so difficult. But willingness, I would imagine, is often there until the pain gets so bad, both physical and psychological pain, that you return to your substance to get rid of the withdrawals, both physical and psychological.
Yeah. Yeah. Those stages of change are important to keep in mind. You've got to at least get to those beginning stages of some basic self-awareness and the desire to change. And then you're going to need help, you know, most likely, because by definition, addictive patterns get deeper ingrained than our self-control can just nip them in the bud, you
right.
know. But I am a fan, just on this topic of readiness for change, a fan of drawing from motivational interviewing along the way to help people get there. And there are even some manualized approaches to helping people with alcohol, smoking cessation that I think pair well with psychedelics too. Because just to give you an example, here are a couple MI-based questions. Mm-hmm. To start a collaborative conversation, you could do this with your client, your loved one. What are your goals for life and how does your substance use fit in with these goals? What are some of the things you value most in your life and how does your substance use affect those things? What are some of the positive changes you've experienced when you've been able to stop using substances? How has your substance use affected your relationships with family and friends? And you can kind of see how an experience inward of a psychedelic where you can't stop it, you've signed on for the ride, you've buckled up, and you're getting this life review perhaps, and you're seeing a lot of this stuff, you're feeling a lot of stuff, you're emotionally available for that experience. That's when you can have the good kind of heartbreaking wake-up call. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the way motivational interviewing sort of asks these leading questions, but in a non-judgmental way. They're not saying like, you know, look at all the damage that's been done. Why do you keep behaving this way? Which is what a lot of people who are addicted to substances and other things get from their loved ones.
Yeah, that's a really good point because just like the war on drugs is misguided, I think our culture even like... The non-governmental parts of the culture are far too judgmental about addiction, not seeing it for what it is, like a chronic mental health condition in need of help.
Yeah, and sort of balancing back and forth on this tightrope, we should also validate that the loved ones of people who are addicted to things, that can be really, really hard.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when the person that you've loved changes, like they start behaving in ways that they would never have behaved before, like, you know, with dishonesty and theft or whatever they've ended up resorting to stay out of the pain that they're in caused by withdrawal.
So as a loved one, family member of someone like in the throes of addiction, like you, I believe you can have that stance of non-judgmental compassion and still the difficult task of setting boundaries and doing what needs to be done, knowing that the spiral of addiction can wreak havoc on all those around you. And none of this, either side of the coin of this, is to suggest that someone should, you know, stay in a harmful place to try and support someone. And we do need better and better resources for all involved.
Yeah. For all involved, and I'm circling back now to your statement about AA being helpful in part because of peer support.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, is it Johann Hari? I always forget the person who wrote Lost Connections.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, drawing attention to the fact that a lot of what drives addiction is suffering. And a lot of that suffering is suffering because we are disconnected, because we are alone. And that people tend to, they tend not to get hooked by addictions when they are loved and supported and generally mentally healthy and well-resourced economically and socially, all those things.
Yeah.
And if people are addicted, their outcomes tend to be better if they have those variables in place. If we're alone and under-resourced, it can be really, really hard to kick something like this.
Yeah, there is nothing like the presence of a supportive other to give you the... energy and like extra dose of like of sustenance to surf to the other side of a craving, right? Like just having being seen and having some purpose in those connections goes so far.
Yeah. Yeah, it's part of why I love the idea of a sponsor, right? And a lot of these 12-step programs is somebody, when you're in the throes of a craving, you're somebody you can talk to, somebody you can reach out to, somebody you can get connection with.
Yeah, and it's interesting to look at all this from a Buddhist lens as well, because this is like a couple thousand years ago, this idea, I think they call dependent origination or something in Buddhism, but like a cue, a stimulus comes into your mind. It's interpreted inside us as pleasant or unpleasant. And then we have this natural urge to make unpleasant go away and make the pleasant thing stay. We're kind of wired as humans that way. But in a Buddhist lens, they call that like the birth of self, lower us self maybe, or self-identity, where we start to get identified with our actions, and then these actions get reinforced, perpetuated, like we know from kind of Buddhist wisdom and you know, psychology, you know, the study of human behavior. And this all happens initially in ignorance because we aren't seeing the world clearly. Like, you know, whether you're young or growing up or in the throes of it and haven't seen it yet, or because you're just caught up behind the veil of this illusion. You know, we might call it a subjective bias because we're just learning to behave based on the response to previous actions. I guess the Buddhists have this other kind of way out, is to cut through the veil of that illusion that is at the root of the suffering.
Yeah, is that related to this, the Buddhist notion of just attachments being the root of suffering, attachment to desire?
And aversions, like avoiding uncomfortable things. Whether it's a Buddhist approach or a yogic approach, the philosophies, you know, have these lists of traps that the human condition has, and systematic ways out of it using like contemplative practices.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which psychedelics can, in my opinion, accelerate.
Yeah. And I don't know, I guess just to zoom out again, I don't know that the research we have right now shows us really, really clearly what the mechanisms of action are, whether they're psychological mechanisms of action or neurological, that make psychedelics potentially a really good treatment for addiction. So Reed and I are doing some speculation and some just sort of philosophizing here. The data are promising in the terms of outcomes, but we don't necessarily know why.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're just drawing on these theories. You got B.F. Skinner's ideas from the 50s. You got like what we know about positive and negative reinforcement, and then what we know about specific substances, right? Like, you know, we know the relative rates of addiction of a given substance, and it's not 100%. You know, it depends a lot, like you were talking about, on what's going on in one's life and the supports that surround us. And the co-occurring conditions like mood episodes, et cetera. But like in alcoholism, you can avoid things a little more easily, like people who are drinking or places that have alcohol, a little more easily than smoking, where people would smoke in the car or the elevator or whatever. So, you know, and then we have these approaches like Nicorette gum, patches, eating a carrot instead of smoking, not getting to the root like we're talking about. I think it's in the Dhammapada, this Buddhist book. It talks about just as a tree cut down can grow again and again if its roots are undamaged and strong, the roots of craving you can cut down. If you don't uproot them fully, like go to the core and do the work, then the sorrows will just sprout again and again.
Yeah, I like that metaphor. It jives with some of my own personal experiences with psychedelics and how they've gone after cravings that I have in my life. I mean, so kind of the innocuous ones that I often talk about in examples like this are, you know, if I'm not eating in a way that's really healthy for my body, and then, you know, I have an ayahuasca ceremony, oftentimes some of the first insights, the first awarenesses that I have are how I've been treating my body, whether by not sleeping well enough or not, you know, nourishing my body with nourishing foods or exercising in a way that's kind to my body and supportive.
Yeah.
And repeatedly. And it's pretty rare that I come out of a psychedelic experience and really, really wanting Doritos, you know, or really, really wanting to sit on the couch and scroll TikTok for hours.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? Hannah and I, just this morning, were talking about how interesting it is that our LSD study participants, you know, at some point later on in the day, we'll order in food, mm-hmm. right? And no one's ever asked for a hamburger.
Yeah. Yeah, we usually, the menus that we have for the participants are usually, you know, some healthy food options.
But yeah, there was this article in The Onion mm-hmm. that said, your comment made me think of, is like, Doritos celebrates its 1 millionth ingredient. Or something. But like you mentioned Doritos, I just think it's ironic because they are like fabricated for the perfect experience of habit forming snacking.
Right.
Like down to the perfect tone of a crunch and the flavor. Like, I mean, I brought a big bag of Doritos to a holiday party over the weekend and people love them.
I said Doritos, full transparency, because I ate an entire bag of Doritos over the weekend. They were organic Doritos. They're better, but
yeah.
Yeah. It's like a gustatory orgasm when you eat those things. They're designed to be addictive in so many different ways in a laboratory.
Yeah. There was this New York Times article once upon a time. It said like the extraordinary science of junk food, of mm-hmm. addictive junk food or something.
Yeah, this is a total tangent, but it just makes me think of like the way things have been designed by people who know human psychology. And this is the smartphone apps that we use, you know, the social media, this is the foods. This is, in fact, that if you ever want to have a fun sort of stroll down this particular rabbit hole, you can look up the origin of Febreze. And other, like, Febreze was going to be a failed product until they were like, I forget the ad campaign was something about use Febreze at the end of your cleaning, like as a sort of a cherry on the top of end your cleaning. And it sort of through the sort of the Skinnerian learning channels was conditioning people to associate the smell, which out of context, I think the smell of Febreze is gross, but to associate the smell with cleanliness.
Oh yeah.
So like people get this sense that like I'm spraying Febreze on it as if Febreze is, I mean, hope we don't get sued by Febreze, but as if Febreze is cleaning something. It's not cleaning anything. It's just perfuming it.
Yeah.
If anything, adding a bunch of chemicals that not great for you to inhale.
In that same vein though, just like the evil marketing empires can use neuroscience to our disadvantages, consumer victims, like we can also
the dark side of the force.
We can also hack our own neural habit loop reward circuitry by just understanding some basics and taking an inventory of our habit loops. But I just keep thinking about social media as a phenomenon that is just becoming more and more of an addictive pattern for people. And maybe we can take a little tangential journey through some neuroimaging studies because I find them interesting.
If you've got them, let's walk through them.
Let's go like on a 10-year journey here. Mm-hmm. It was like an fMRI study at Harvard that put young people in a scanner and they had two conditions, give them money or have them talk about themselves. And during doing this task in a functional MRI scanner, they get to see how much the nucleus accumbens, the reward center, the ventral tegmental area spewing dopamine, you know, giving you that spike is lit up. And people were definitely lit up much more by talking about themselves. So there's something rewarding about that. Next year, there's this study where they could almost predict how much time someone would spend on Facebook by how much their nucleus accumbens was activated in a scanner by looking at social media.
Wow, interesting.
But so they put, this is like, I don't know, 2016, they put adolescents in a scanner and they showed them their own Instagram feed and they manipulated it. One group had few likes and one group had a lot of likes. And how they manipulated it, the more versus fewer likes, had a very significant change in the nucleus accumbens activation. So they were essentially showing this link between reward, self, like talking about self, posting about oneself. So And then you have these studies since then of like a linear correlation with between the likelihood of being depressed and a likelihood of spending more time on social media. So then this loop of the more we use it to try and make ourselves feel better, the more we get stuck in that habit loop of a temporary spike, desensitizing to some of the normal pleasures, hypersensitivity to some of the stressors, and then this difficult cycle that makes some people go, like, just have a wake-up call one day and exit the cycle, delete apps, and reclaim their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a song as old as time. We're finding now that that pattern that you just laid out is applicable probably to a lot of different things, not only social media, yeah, video games, pornography, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's given rise to the popularity of the so-called dopamine detox, where people will do, yep, what you said. They'll just like, okay, no more smartphone. For me, it's when I go on prolonged camping trips or, you know, mountain excursions and I don't have my, mm-hmm, phone and I'm in nature. And at first I'm a little restless and then I'm just at peace. And then I come home and I don't really want to jump right back on social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a good reminder to try and find a daily detox. Like, talk about, like, is there an hour in your day you could have your phone not with you, not in the same room, right? Like, for how many people would that be impossible, right? It shouldn't
really,
be
really
these
hard,
days.
Yeah.
It'd be hard, and we might have a reaction to that. But, I don't know, it's just something I found really useful, because it does have a magnetic pull that's often beneath this level of our conscious awareness.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah, before bed's a good time too, because then you're not exposing your eyeballs to that blue spectrum light that suppresses, you know, melatonin production and keeps you up at night.
Some side benefits.
Side benefits.
Thanks, Huberman, for the neuro-optogenetics research.
Yeah. He's got a lot of good resources on the dopamine detox, and he had that long conversation with, is it Anna Lemke, the Dopamine Nation author, and
mm-hmm, the Molecule of More, they call it.
Yeah. Which is the title of the other book, like the two big dopamine books, Molecule of More. I forget the authors. There's co-authors for that one, but
yeah.
And then Dopamine Nation, also sort of supported the rise in popularity of cold plunging, you know, cold and hot contrast, and it's the ways that it can help regulate dopamine systems.
Yeah, like your ability to sit with the discomfort is the next battle, mm-hmm, I'd say. So awareness is half the battle, right? You've got to take an inventory of your patterns. You got to be able to slow down time with mindfulness to be in the present moment and see as these triggers are happening in real time, and then try and insert a pause, interrupt the pattern. Like if it's a urge to binge eat on food, for example, and you know that can spin out of control in you, then, you know, you try and catch that as it's happening, and you might have a plan. Like, I'm going to set a timer for 30 minutes, and agree to myself that I'm not going to eat a thing until I try 1, 2, 3, 4. But that brings up the next battle, is what are the tools you use, you have to sit with the discomfort? What skills and confidence can you build?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. If you're curious about more details on this, we have a couple episodes in our archive about habits, habit formation, habit breaking. But I don't know, what are some of your favorite tools to that end to help manage craving and sit with discomfort?
Yeah. And, I mean, the breath, it sounds cliche, but I think I'm just biased from having spent countless hours over many years on a yoga mat, mm-hmm, you know, practicing some of these things, like getting into weird positions where your nervous system is activated because your butt is in the sky and your head's on the ground and you're twisted up a little bit. And then, like, that's even a prescription for anxiety in India, like a pose like that, because you're training the nervous system to get into some discomfort. And then you're bringing on that parasympathetic response by staying there, by breathing, by trying to find this balance of effort and ease. So sitting, meditation, and yoga, like embodiment practices, things with the breath, frequent meditations throughout the day. And then, you know, all those other ones you mentioned, like practicing doing some uncomfortable things on purpose, like cold plunge, sananga, painful eye drops, hape spray in the nose, mm-hmm. or snuff.
Right. Yeah, sometimes it's just like a little baby step into this. I'll recommend my clients spend the last 10 seconds of their shower with water that's just cold enough to be uncomfortable. You don't have to go freezing cold.
I like
but
that.
But deliberately put yourself in sort of that uncomfortable state as a vote for the kind of person you want to be in the future. And I found that to be really helpful personally. And then getting really, really present. So you mentioned mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I like, if I'm aware and willing to engage this discomfort, one of the ways that I can help myself do it is to change my perspective or my vantage point, where mm-hmm. I'm going to look at this discomfort as if I'm a forensic reporter or an investigator. I'm going to get really curious about it. So, okay, I'm noticing this pull. I'm noticing this burning in my stomach. I'm noticing restlessness. In true mindfulness fashion, you're just trying to zoom out and observe from this non-judgmental, dispassionate perspective.
Including your negative emotions or just your emotional world in general. I think that's part of it that I know we talk about a lot on here, but I'm just remembering how important that is in the mindfulness practice for these urges, for being able to surf the urges to the other side without like succumbing to a very maladaptive pattern that you're trying to avoid, would be ability to regulate negative emotion. Something that happens to be impaired by nature of an addiction. Mm-hmm. So that much more important to practice in this addictive kind of culture we live in.
Yeah, and don't confuse the word regulate with control. Yeah. Some people will come out of therapy or they'll make some assumptions about the kind of thing we're talking about to mean that we should be in control of our emotions. Mm-hmm. I had a client say once that he never wants to feel angry again. And so we had to have a conversation about the nature of anger. And that I get what he's saying, that the way anger has manifested in his life, he doesn't want to respond to anger in the way that he's responded in the past. But to regulate emotions does not mean to never experience certain emotions or completely control them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really good point, because we do talk a lot about that surrender. You essentially, to regulate them means to, you know, surrender to the rise and fall of them, let them pass without chasing them with a baseball bat, trying to swat them away or squash them.
Yeah. Or react to their emergence in a way that's different. I mean, that part maybe you can control. So if I feel the rise of anger in my body triggered by something one of my kids says, I then have a choice to make. And sometimes it doesn't feel like a choice. A lot of people will say, I just sort of explode or I just react. Well, one of the purposes of doing psychedelic work around this or doing meditative work is to create enough awareness to create some space between stimulus and response so that you can then make a choice. You still feel it. I still clench my fists and I feel the flush in my face. I get angry. But if I'm doing this work, then I'm much more capable. It's not 100%, but much more capable of breathing and then being able to choose to behave in a way that's consistent with my values, with the kind of person I want to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I had a thought and now it's disintegrated.
I have that effect on people. Yep. When I'm rambling, I disintegrated your thought.
Well, good. Cause I'm being present. So present with nothing to say now.
Yep. We'll just have a moment of silence on the pod while Reed and I are extremely present to our empty minds.
Okay. So on top of this mindfulness, we start to layer on techniques. We're talking about tools, practices for sitting with discomfort. They might be cognitive therapy, appraisal techniques. They might be kind of reframing the stressors as an opportunity for personal growth, sense of meaning, things like that. But on top of that, from our conversation with Eric Garland at the University of Utah and his great work on mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement, there's this idea of savoring that is part of their process that I think we were both really struck by.
It's
how
impressive.
Useful it is. Yeah. So it makes more of this really unique approach because they, as part of the program, focus mindful attention on what is pleasant and beautiful in life, like everyday experiences. So you can reclaim what was lost, like your dopamine spike, your positive reinforcement from the normal healthy things around you, like food, or in his example, he brings in a rose, a bouquet of roses, and they'll touch the petals, they'll see how it feels in their fingertips, open their eyes, just stare at it, smell it, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this idea of savoring being a tool to recuperate a burned out dopamine system, right? It makes sense from a phenomenologically psychological perspective, but also I imagine from this neurological perspective of just gently reintroducing normative stimuli for your dopamine system.
Yeah, and he's having them oscillate between the inner feelers and the outer feelers. Like, how does it feel as you touch it, as you look at it, smell it, and what emotions are coming up inside? Mm. And an interesting thing starts to happen when you do that. This, like, try doing that on a psychedelic journey, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, I still have a rose given to me from an ayahuasca ceremony in a far off land that's dried up and sitting on my home little mini altar,
oh,
right?
Cool.
Yeah, but an interesting thing happens. You can almost start to touch into this sense of oneness, closeness, connectedness with the object. But there's something beyond that. Like Ram Dass says, you love a tree, you love a cat, you love that which you love, and you keep expanding it until eventually you touch into the source. Mm. And I think that's that sense of oneness with the object they're savoring is really replenishing of that sense of oneness you can get with life and others.
Yeah. Oneness and complete presence. And,
yeah.
You know, by one interpretation, an addiction is an addiction to getting away from how you feel in the present moment. Because it's,
yeah,
like we were talking about before, it's suffering. So these tools that you're describing that are a part of more and other sort of mindfulness-oriented approaches are about a lot of things, but one of the things that they're about is reconnecting with what is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can see how this can then be, all of these things we're talking about can be useful for these everyday patterns. Like it's not about, you know, addiction isn't just about substance use disorders, right? We are wired for habit as beings. We are what we repeatedly do. And, you know, we're raised in a culture that often says, you know, stressed, eat a cupcake or something like that. And if cupcakes are becoming maladaptive in your life and you notice you're craving one when you're sad, you know, from a mechanism perspective, you can understand that. And it gets really interesting because you can be, oh, what happens if I don't go for the cupcake? I'm going to sit in this uncomfortable negative emotion for a minute. But then emotions do rise and fall, especially as you surrender to them and let them move. And they also give you information about how to navigate life. So you've got this wisdom from inside. You've got some skills and confidence from sitting with it. Little victories that go a long way because all of a sudden, and there's research to back this, like if you think you can overcome an urge or you think you have the confidence, you're much more likely to actually do it because you're mm-hmm. not coming from a hopeless place to that fight.
Yeah. Hope is an incredible drug.
Yeah.
If you want to get high on a drug, get high on hope. But you're right. There are, it's good empirical. I mean, it's intuitive, right? But there's also lots of empirical data that suggests that when people feel encouraged and they feel like they can do it, they will put forth a lot more effort, among other things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what else shall we say about addiction and psychedelics?
Well, I think as we wrap up, just speaking generally about psychedelics, I think in addition to the things we've talked about, why we think a psychedelic experience might be helpful for somebody who's addicted, people often rate psychedelic experiences as in the top, you know, whatever, five or number one most meaningful experiences of their lives. And there's a lot of reasons why it feels meaningful. One of them is, you mentioned oneness before, it's like a connection to a greater perspective, or for some folks, it's a connection to the divine, or a rejoining with the universe. And there's a kind of perspective that is granted to a person when they've had an experience like this that is very powerful and very unique. right? You only see it in people who have had near-death experiences or psychedelic experiences like I'm discussing or profound religious experiences, but a connection to something that is greater than yourself. And substance use disorders or addictions to certain behaviors that are destructive often shrink a person down to just themselves. And it's part of why being in a relationship with someone like this can be very difficult, because they can behave and appear very, very self-absorbed and very selfish because they're in so much pain. So my hypothesis is that that's one of the mechanisms of change, one of the mechanisms of action in a psychedelic experience. It's this grand perspective granting experience that then enables willingness. It enables these durable changes, whereas, you know, simple behavior therapy might not. More brute force compared to something like that.
I agree. I think that's a great, big, important point to land on. And something I think Carl Jung even said back in his day, if only he could occasion a spiritual experience for people in the throes of addiction. And you know, I feel the same way working with clients. If there's one thing I could wish would be that experience of transcending the ordinary and connecting to something greater than yourself to be able to pull you out. The most powerful thing I've seen in action, and we see it in these cases like Bill Wilson, AA, that was his experience, the AA curriculum, have a God experience. I was just presenting on eating disorders and psychedelics. There's a case report from the 50s of a woman with anorexia, very deeply ingrained maladaptive pattern, who had a couple psilocybin experiences, and it was the choir of angels kind of experiences that were the most helpful in pulling her from that pattern. And I think it's a really important point. And I'll just add an Alan Watts quote, a little really basic one that sums it up nicely. He says, "Ego, the self which he has believed himself to be, is nothing but a pattern of habits." Mm. And so if we can tone that down, we still need some ego to function, right? Tone it down so it's not the driver, and get that capital S self in the driver's seat, then we can start to reclaim our behavior patterns.
Yeah, it gives you options. It gives you agency.
Yeah.
And to a person who's addicted, agency feels like a far reach. So to be able to provide them a profound, transcendent experience where agency is returned to them is priceless. So I'm hopeful that the research will continue, and then we'll get to use these medicines in clinic on the reg and help a lot of people.
Yep. The train has left the station. Studies are underway. So, exciting times, Steve.
Exciting times. Well, thanks, Reed.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.